So, little children, today it is March 11th, 2023. It's 1847 hours currently, Eastern Standard Time. Today's study is Genesis 11 and the Wild Road article, part 1, chapter 3, paragraph 8. And we had looked just yesterday at this table of the dates in the reign of Akhenaten, the Pharaoh of Egypt, whose year one was somewhere around 1375, but we noticed that the first 5 years or so of his reign seemed to reflect a possible year one in 1376 for him in that table. So shall we read paragraph 3-8 now and see what comments are made here? An examination of the dates in table 3-1 above make it clear that March 1375 is a reasonable starting point for the reign of Akhenaten, and with a December 1376 accession, the dates during his first 5 years reflecting 1376. The establishment of the new city, the establishment of the new capital city at Amarna is known to have been an event in year 5 of this pharaoh. So that's very interesting. It is hard to say whether lunar alignment mattered for Akhenaten after he began Aten worship, that's the sun worship, in year 5, he worshipped the sun, since Amarna constituted a break for him from the tradition. So whether he kept worshipping the moon in some sense, it's not clear. This makes it more difficult to date his reign, surely, but it makes the analysis of his dates more of import. In other words, the analysis is more significant. The most important date from the time at Amarna is the foundation ceremony, lunar day 2, March 11th, 1370. Look at that. Today's March 11th. And in March 11th, 13 BCE, there was a lunar day 2, which corresponds, it appears, to the foundation ceremony, which date is 4 Parrot 13, and it had an anniversary the next year as a year 6 lunar day 13. Every year the lunar day number goes forward approximately 11 days, so it changes from 2 to 13. Both of these dates are waxing moons, and the first is typical of a foundation ceremony happening near a lunar day 1. After that, the fact that not all dates look waxing is hinting at the lesser concession to Amun after year 5. Further study of the dating of Akhenaten is warranted and will hopefully proceed as soon as time may permit. So that's all we can say for now, but it certainly is warranted to study this a little bit, or maybe a lot more in depth. So we may be doing that study and going further in that analysis of these dates for Akhenaten. But for now, that's what we've got. And I had no idea that this March 11th was going to come up. I went shopping today. This is March 11th for me here. You know, in my time zone, Eastern Standard Time, I'm tired because I went out today. I got my car out for the first time in quite a while. The battery, when I got back, was just as charged as it was when I left. It didn't need charging. So my car battery, the car works fine. I still lose my airbags, I think, when I go out. But I didn't lose my airbag on the departure. I had the airbag on departure. I just didn't have it on the way back. But I found out from somewhere on YouTube, I could probably just reset these codes and I can get the airbag working by, because I always have my scanner. I can use the scanner to reset the error code and possibly get the airbag back. While I'm on the road, it's possible. I haven't tried that yet, but it's not that important because I don't really want an airbag. I don't want the airbag going off in my face at 25 miles an hour. I'm not going to get in a high-speed collision, so, or it's not likely to say that it won't be because I'm driving fast. So I don't see why I should have airbags anyway. I'm not going to drive this car at highway speed, so at least that's my intention, to not drive it at highway speed. It's my Odyssey, my Honda Odyssey, that's still working excellently. In fact, the transmission's working better than it was, because I did put that transmission RX, or whatever it's called, from some company that makes a cure. They make a liquid to put in your transmission that will supposedly fix some of the problems with the Honda transmissions. In fact, it can make them completely vanish by getting rid of the sludge that's in there, or whatever it is that's causing the transmission to not shift properly. And so I read these good reviews by individuals online, and I thought I'd try it. So at some point I should replace the transmission fluid, which is now diluted partly with this whatever it's called, something RX. RX means prescription in English. So it's in my email somewhere because I ordered it and got an email about it probably. So I know I could find out the name, but it's a very good product apparently, because my car is working fine right now. I don't think that the problems it used to have are there anymore with the transmission. Today, I had a very nice encounter. I met somebody interesting out shopping, so I am... Yeah, I had a lot of things in common with this gentleman. So, what am I going to say about this now? Oh yeah, didn't I say in paragraph one that the year one of Akhenaten was 1375? Excuse me. I've just eaten quite a bit of food, so I'm having a little bit of gas, I'm burping a little bit back of the air I swallowed. Okay, so, well, it's long been common to date Akhenaten 1375 to 1358, as we saw in paragraph 1-1 at the very beginning of the article. But I know I'd been saying that possibly it was late in 1375 when Akhenaten took the throne, but okay, I don't know if I was saying that now, but if I was, it was apparently wrong, or possibly wrong, but oh, there it is. From early December 1375, year one. That's possible. If Akhenaten began to rule in 1376, very late in 1376, then some date that wasn't quite so late in 1375 could be year one. However, if year 17 in paragraph 1-3 here. Why is that doing that? Okay, in paragraph 1-1, it's been common to date Akhenaten 1375 to 1358, and that's been so for a long time. And recently there was an announcement made as described in paragraph 1-1. But in 1-3, I mentioned that December 1375, year 1, was something about Akhenaten here, but specifically a year 17. In see, at the time I wrote this paragraph, I hadn't yet analyzed all the dates for Akhenaten, and I didn't know about the 1376. I believe that's what happened. So we might want to reconsider all of what was written in the earlier portions of this article before Table 3-1, where the date of year 1 for Akhenaten was apparently shifted back a little bit to 1376, very late in 1376. But his official year 1 didn't begin until 1375. That seems to fit. Everything seems to fit. So it's still right. But if you look here, September 13th, 1358 would be 17 years and some months after 1375 March. So that would be actually year 18. So at the time I wrote this, I believed that December 1375 was the beginning of Akhenaten's reign. And none of these things are necessarily fatal to our theories or to our chronology. It's just perhaps we've missed some point about how the Egyptians calculated the year's beginning. We just may have missed something about that. It could be something that simple, or it could be something more involved than that. But let's just see, different from that. But in this analysis, it was 16 years and some 9 months after December 1375. It would have been year 17 if Akhenaten began to rule in late 1375. Okay, but that's not necessary, is it? So let's look at... let's consider something here. Let's consider 1357 for Akhenaten. It was second Akhet 17, or Phaophi 17. It's the other name of the month. Second Akhet is Phaophi. So Phaophi 17. Let's try 1357. Okay. Let's put a minus sign into the year field, and we look for 1357 after backspacing out the other numbers. 1357, we want second Akhet. That's the first month of Shemir. Second Akhet will be, okay, we could have gone either forward or back. Phaophi, there's Phaophi, second Akhet 15. And we want Phaophi 17. That is Phaophi 17. But that's 1358. We want 1357. And we want Phaophi 17. We have to correct it by one day. It's September 12th. But we also want plus the time zone of Egypt. There it is. Phaophi 17 to get the lunar day number. It's lunar day 5. That's brilliant. That looks correct, because lunar day 5 is a much better lunar day to do some official dating, or to carry out some task like bottling wine and then recording the date. a lunar day 5 is far preferable because it's in the first 5 days after the new moon. That's remarkable. I mean, that's important. So Phaethon 1357 BCE would be September 12th instead of the 13th, but it's also, that's irrelevant what day it is in the Julian calendar. It's the lunar day that's interesting. And that would be then, but that's the wrong date too. I just realized. That's going a year, another year forward. That's year 18. Or 19, if we go back to year 1, 1376. We did that wrong. So let's, what if we went the other way? We go to 1359. What happens then? It would be lunar day 12, Phaethon 17. It's still a waxing moon. There we go. September 13th, 1359 BCE, Phaethon 17. That would fall in his year 17 if, and that would give 2 years after his death before Tutankhamun would take the throne in 1357. But that would be consistent with the year 1 of 1376, interestingly. But we know later on, after his year 5, that his year 1 was from table 3-1 considered to be March 1375, as the evidence in that table shows. In table 3-1 here in paragraph 3-7, yeah. So those are all the numbers we looked at yesterday. So you see, this is the kind of work that needs to be done, the kind of study you need to do to keep, continue to study it and sort it out. So that's all for today, for that study. 3-9, we're going to get into more details of, oh, it's a long paragraph too, more details regarding the dates of the kings who ruled around the end of the reign of Akhenaten. And here it says his year 17 appears to be 1359. That's interesting, isn't it? It is, yes. Because we just talked about 1359 as a number we could calculate based on year 1, 1376. And, you know, a date late in 1376 leads to many dates in 1359, which are still in Akhenaten's year 17. So this is very, we're in complete concurrence and congruence with what is written in the upcoming paragraph. And now for today, that's all for that article. We're going to move on, hopefully now, to Genesis chapter 11. But instead of reading the Masoretic text version of it, because the dates for very many of these ancestors of Abraham, or Abram, these dates are the numbers of years, that is, that these ancestors lived before they had a child, or a son, that is, and before that son was born, who would actually carry on the lineage and be recorded here. They differ from the numbers in the Septuagint version. So we want to get the Septuagint version for this study, because even the years that they lived after having their son, those years are different too. And typically they were not different earlier in Genesis between the two versions, the Septuagint and the Masoretic text, but these numbers are different both in the length of the generation, which is the time before a father has his son. In other words, how old he is when he has his son. And they're different in that respect by 100 years, in many cases, not all cases. There's a case where there's a difference, for example, with Nahor. It says 29 years, and it's 79 years in the Septuagint, so it's a difference of 50 years. But many of them are 100 years different, and that's just for the length of the generation or the age of the father at the birth of his son. But the other things that are different are that it's true also that the years that the fathers lived after having their sons until they died, those years are also different between the different versions. So because we prefer the older manuscript, which is the Septuagint, we're going to go there. Chapter 11 of Genesis says, "And the whole earth was one lip, and there was one speech for all." That means one language, right? Or one spoken language. "And it came about as they moved from the east," and there's a difference there as well. In the Masoretic text, it says, "In their journeying eastward," it says they journeyed eastward in the Septuagint. In the Masoretic text, it says they journeyed eastward, and in the Septuagint, it says they moved from the east. That's not the same as eastward, they're going westward. "And they found a plain in the land of Shinar," it's called Sinar in the Septuagint, "and settled there." So they settled there in Shinar. "And one person said to the next, 'Come, let us make bricks and bake them with fire.' And the brick became stone for them, and the clay for them was bitumen. And they said, 'Come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower whose top shall be as far as the sky. And let us make a name for ourselves before we are scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth.' And the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built. And the Lord said," this is referring to Jehovah, "the Lord said, 'Look, one race and one lip of all. And this they have begun to do. And nothing that they undertake to do will now be wanting from them. Come, and let us go down and confuse their tongue there, so that they will not hear, each one, the speech of the next.' And the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of all the earth. And they left off building the city and the tower. Therefore, its name was called Confusion." Sounds like the name for Babel, doesn't it? "Because the Lord confused the lips of all the earth, and from there the Lord God scattered them abroad over the face of all the earth. And these are the generations of Sem," or Shem. Shem was 100. Shem was a son of 100 years. In other words, he was 100 years old. Shem was a son of 100 years when he became the father of Arphaxad, in the second year after the flood. So 9 months for a pregnancy, so he must have not been having relations with his wife during the flood, it would appear. Or at least she didn't get pregnant at that time. And Shem lived after he became the father of Arphaxad. Arphaxad is the form of the name in the Masoretic text. 500 years he lived after he became the father of Arphaxad, and he had sons and daughters and died. And Arphaxad lived 100 35 years and became the father of Cainan. And Arpachshad lived after he became the father of Cainan 430 years and had sons and daughters and died. And Cainan lived 130 years and became the father of Shelah. And Cainan lived after he became the father of Shelah 330 years and had sons and daughters and died. There's 100 years difference between these numbers of 130 and the numbers of the Masoretic, which say 30. And Shelah lived 130 years and became the father of Eber. And Shelah lived after he became the father of Eber 330 years and had sons and daughters and died. So you see, prior to the deluge, men were living 180, 190 years before they had a son. So it seems a little bit drastic to assume that after the... It might appear that way, that it's a bit of a drastic change for them to suddenly be only 30 years old when they had their first son, or when they had a son, after the deluge, which is a big change, whereas for it to be 130, it's not changed much from 190. Now, granted, the other numbers were also lower in the Masoretic text, so they would have changed by 90 years, I suppose. But not really, no. That's not true. Actually, I speak a little bit in error there. If we go to... Well, we're already looking at Genesis. Let's look at Genesis 5. When we look at just before the deluge, Methuselah lived 187 years before he became father to Lamech. And Lamech lived 182 years before he became father to Noah. So there's no reason under heaven that we could imagine that would explain this drastic change after the deluge all of a sudden, or that would even be conceivable, that we would think was reasonable, that all of a sudden, from 180 years old, the fathers were 30 years old before they had their son. A big change for now, mind you, the earth changed, the sky changed, a lot of things changed as a result of the deluge, but the Septuagint seems to have a much more reasonable change after the deluge compared to before. So, Arpachshad lived 135 years and became the father of Cainan, right? And then Cainan lived 130 years and became the father of Shelah. And Cainan lived after he became the father of Shelah 330 years and had sons and daughters and died. And Shelah lived 130 years and became the father of Eber. And Shelah lived after he became the father of Eber 330 years and had sons and daughters and died. And Eber lived 134 years and became the father of Phalek, or Peleg, as he's called in the Masoretic text. And Eber lived after he became the father of Peleg 370 years and had sons and daughters and died. 370 years after. Now compare that, verse 16, with the Masoretic text. And we're in chapter 11. Eber lived on for 34 years, then he became father to Peleg. What happened? What's wrong? Hang on. I had a glitch. I had a glitch here. There we go. And I didn't do my setting. I didn't set my brightness either. Let's set the brightness too. think, right there. Okay. So, Eber continued. Eber continued to live 430 years in the Masoretic text after fathering Peleg. On the other hand, he lived 370 years after he became the father of Peleg in the Septuagint. 370 compared to 430. So they're completely different, just 60 years different. There's no rhyme nor reason to the differences. And Peleg lived 130 years and became the father of Ragau. Or who is that called? Reu in the Masoretic text, or Ragau in the Septuagint. So let's call him Reu and call Phelek Peleg. So Peleg became the father of Reu, and Peleg lived after he became the father of Reu 209 years and had sons and daughters and died, as opposed to the same number, 209. In this case, 209 years in the Masoretic text, 209. And once again, the difference is here not the 209, but the 130 years before he became the father of Reu. Verse 18, 130 years in the Septuagint, and only 30 years in the Masoretic text. 30 years before he became father to Reu. Okay, so let's continue on with the Septuagint again. And Reu lived 132 years and became the father of Serug, as he's called in the Masoretic text. And Reu lived after he became the father of Serug 207 years and had sons and daughters and died. That's verse 20. And Reu lived only 32 years in the Masoretic text before he became father to Serug. Afterward, he lived 207 years. 32 and 207 compared to 132 and 207 right. 132 and 207 after Reu became the father of Serug, it was 207 years that he lived and had sons and daughters and died. Verse 21, 207, but verse 20 was 132 years old when he had the son called Serug. 132 and 207. Here it's 32 and 207. So there's still 100 years difference in the overall lifespan for Reu. And now we're nearly approaching the end here. So Serug lived 130 years and became the father of Nahor, according to the Septuagint. And Serug lived after he became the father of Nahor 200 years and had sons and daughters and died. The Masoretic text, it's only 30 years that he lived, did Serug, before he became father to Nahor. And then he lived 200 years afterwards, after fathering. So a total of 230 years, and he became father to sons and daughters during some of the time after he fathered Nahor. And it's 200 years is the same, but that part's the same, verse 23. But the 130 years of the Septuagint is 100 years more than the 30 years of the Masoretic text. We see many different discrepancies, but they're similar in some ways. So we need to finish this chapter now. And Nahor lived for 79 years in the Septuagint, but 29 years in the Masoretic, and became father of Terah. And Nahor lived after he became the father of Terah 129 years and had sons and daughters and died. 79 and 129 compared to 119 and 29 years. And Terah lived on for 70 years, after which he became father to Abram, Nahor, and Haran. And here the two manuscripts from Haran roughly agree. Almost exactly, I believe. Terah lived 70 years and became the father of Abram, Nahor, and Haran. But then, yeah, we have to go to the next page to finish this in the Septuagint. Finish this chapter. These then are the generations of Terah. Terah was the father of Abram and Nahor and Haran, and Haran was the father of Lot. And Haran died before his father Terah in the land in which he was born. Haran died in the country of the Chaldeans. And Abram and Nahor took wives for themselves. Abram's wife was Sarah, and Nahor's wife's name was Milcah, the daughter of Haran. Haran being the father of Milcah and the father of Iscah. And Sarah was barren, and she was not bearing children. And Terah took his son Abram and his son's son, Lot, son of Haran, and his daughter-in-law Sarah, his son Abram's wife, and he brought them out of the country of the Chaldeans to go into the land of Canaan. And he came as far as Haran and settled there. And the days of Terah in Haran amounted to 205 years, and Terah died in Haran. That's the end of chapter 11 of Genesis. Little children, I really hope that you enjoyed that. Now listen to what happened in the Masoretic text. It basically says the same thing. Haran died while in the company with Terah his father in the land of his birth in Ur of the Chaldeans, the country of the Chaldeans, it's called in the Septuagint. The word Ur, the city's name, is not mentioned in the Septuagint. And Abram and Nahor proceeded to take wives for themselves. Verse 29. That's what it says in the Septuagint also. And this part about the names of their wives and the relationship that the wives had with the family are the same in the two versions. Sarah was Abram's wife. She was Abram's half-sister, but it doesn't mention that here. But the name of Nahor's wife was Milcah, who was the daughter of Haran, who was also the father of Iscah. That is the same between the two versions. I mean, between the Septuagint and the Masoretic manuscript. They're not versions, they're manuscripts. Not, you know, as opposed to later versions. The daughter of Haran was Milcah, and he was also the father of Iscah. Abram's wife was Sarah, and it doesn't say what relation she was here. We later find out she was the half-sister of Abraham. And then it says, Terah took his son Abram and his son's son, Lot, the son of Haran, and his daughter-in-law, Sarah, Abram's wife, and brought them to go to the land of Canaan, but they only got as far as Haran and settled there. And then he lived to be 205 and died in Haran, according to the Septuagint. So here it says in the Masoretic text, well, here it says also Sarah, as she was called at that point. Her name had not been changed to Sarah yet. which we learned later, we learn about later in Genesis. But she was barren, it says, in the Masoretic text. And in the Septuagint, it also says she was barren and she was not bearing children. There it is, yeah. And he went to go to the land of Canaan and then came to Haran and took up dwelling there. Terah did with Abram his son and Lot the son of Haran his grandson and Sarai, his daughter-in-law, Masoretic text. And Nahor's wife's name was Milcah, we had that. And Terah took his son Abram and his son Lot, the son of Haran, and his daughter-in-law Sarah, or Sarai, Abram's wife, and brought them out of the country of the Chaldeans to go to the land of Canaan, and he came as far as Haran and settled there. Then he lived to be 205. So that part coincides precisely, although it mentions Ur of the Chaldeans in the Masoretic text. It just says the country of the Chaldeans in the Septuagint. He was going to the land of Canaan, though. And that's the same between the two manuscripts. And they only got as far as Haran is also the same. And then Terah lived to be 205 years old. That's also the same. There's an interesting discontinuity in the text. Let me see if I can fix that. No, it's still. I wonder what's happening. Let's see. Something anomalous has happened to the interpretation of this. Display output on the screen here. The wording has gotten distorted here. No, there it is. When I magnified it, doesn't. Okay, it's because of the magnification. That's why. It was because of the magnification. Yeah. So there it is. They came to Haran. They didn't get further, and then Terah lived to be 205 years, and he died in Haran. In both the Masoretic text, and also in the Septuagint, he died in Haran at the age of... Wait a minute. Yes, that's right. Well, in the Septuagint, 205 years. Masoretic text, 205 years. So men were still, at that time, subsequent to the massive flood known as the deluge, men were still living... you know, hundreds of years at that time. Now, Abraham didn't live quite that long. I believe he lived to be 175 years old, and his son Isaac lived to be 185 years old, if I'm recalling correctly, from all the times I've looked that up. But we're going to come to that later. I seem to remember Isaac lived longer than his father by a small number of years, like 10 years. But this is good. We're done the study for today. I'm thrilled because I was pretty tired. I didn't know how I'd get through the study today exactly. Just because I did have many conversations out talking to people at the grocery store today. And so the energy level that I... And even when I left home, I wasn't fully... fully energized because I took 1,000 units of vitamin D today just to see whether it was the vitamin D that was poisoning me, and it did have an effect, a negative effect. So it made me a little more sluggish, it took away my appetite, made me feel very slightly nauseous, very slightly, but it told me that this vitamin D is probably the cause of my predicament, you know, my situation, the way I'm feeling. So it's too much vitamin D is still in my system, and I can't take any vitamin D from now on until at least another, say, 30 days or so would be a good guideline. But I might try again before 30 days, but I'll go at least I'd say at least another 15 days before I even consider taking any vitamin D. So, but I'll eat peanut butter. That seems to be something I can do, and I don't have any ill effect because it's vitamin D2, which I mentioned in a previous video also. And there's so much to learn about nutrition that I can't explain it all, of even the parts that I think I understand. It's difficult to cover all of that. But I don't really know anything in a final sense. It's always an ongoing experience, because when you're deficient in one vitamin or mineral or element in your body, that affects all the other elements and how they interact. And it's such a complex, biological thing, a process and system, a biological system, which we call the human body, is so complex that it's not reasonable to expect to understand it on any level, you know, with any amount of, mastery. Basically impossible to master. Even if we do live forever, it's impossible to master. But we've got to try to learn what we can before we die, so we can try to attain to a longer life. And this is what I was saying before. In order to live forever, we need time to figure out how to live forever. And I think we can do that. We can certainly live longer, because we can live healthier when we know more about how the body works and how the food affects the systems of the body. So, it was a very eventful day. Both I and at least one person with whom I spoke today believed that we were destined to meet, or that we were, it was absolutely, meant to be, that we would meet and have so many things in common. It was really seemingly a very important event for both of us. And we are in email contact, potentially. So, it's good, because we have the ability to be in contact that way, as long as, Jehovah willing, of course. There are too many factors that could cause, any kind of contact to get broken, right? So that's why it requires Jehovah's approval or his blessing, or it requires his will to be involved, that he is involved somehow. I want to say something about the unfortunate event at the Kingdom Hall in Germany that happened recently, where a gunman attacked a Kingdom Hall in Germany, and to the detriment of a number of the brothers and or sisters in the Kingdom Hall, some of whom did indeed lose their lives, at least the life that they have in this system, not their everlasting life, but it's still very troublesome and inexplicable somehow to me. But perhaps it makes us think, it makes us wonder, are we rubbing people the wrong way? When we talk to people, are we making them think that we're unreasonable people, or that are we causing so much pain to other people that they would actually consider taking up arms against us or our congregation or our brothers and sisters? that, I think, has to be one thing that we can learn from this is, or is our reputation so bad in the community that people would consider taking military weapons against us, even when we don't bear weapons ourselves? Or, you know, are these people, I mean, is it possible that someone could be so deranged that they take a gun to someone, to a group of people randomly? I think that's possible too. But then again, we have to also remember that Jehovah is watching over all these things. He knows, and he's capable of protecting the ones who are his servants. So it has to make us, if we're faithful and we believe in the power that Jehovah has, that we have to be aware that even if there were such a thing as random random attacks with firearms, do we not also believe that Jehovah is capable of directing the bullets to go in the proper path so they don't injure his faithful ones? I mean, these are the things that have meaning, right? These are the most important concepts that we need to contemplate, but there are also the concepts of we're all imperfect and we all grieve. Sometimes very terribly, we suffer grief when our loved ones pass away by any kind of death, not just, even by natural means, not just a violent death. So, I mean, we also sympathize with the brothers and sisters who lost loved ones, especially, and all the more so, when we ourselves have lost someone very dear to us. We can deeply appreciate, more so than some others perhaps, what these ones are going through. And the death of a loved one can lead to, I mean, immediately lead, cause the immediate effect of trauma. And that trauma can go on for many years, and anxiety. Anxiety is even magnified when someone lives alone, of course. And, I mean, everything that happens can appear to be, when you're in trauma or having anxiety, it can appear, even the most mundane or minor detail can appear to be of great import, you know, and actually can appear to have such importance as to be a point upon which life itself hangs. So we could believe that if we lose the keys to our house, or if we even misplace our keys temporarily, that could mean the end of our lives. We could have that sort of anxiety, especially when we're alone and we've lost a loved one, and the whole world seems to be enemy to us, you know, seems to be unfriendly toward us. No one befriends us. The whole world can appear to be even more unfriendly when we're in that state of trauma and post-traumatic shock, but also anxiety. And as we get older, the likelihood of having anxiety, I believe, as our health deteriorates, can become greater also. So these things, now, I don't think I'm having any real large effect of old age. So in my case, I appreciate that anxiety can occur for anyone who's lost a loved one. It can be a very great amount of anxiety. And it's nice to have a friend. I think that really helps. But we need to remember also, Jesus is our friend. He wants to be our friend. So much so that he even died he endured and died a very painful death for us. He died for us. He was willing to do that for us. He did it for our benefit. And there is not another name that has been named under heaven by which we must get saved, other than the name of Jesus, the Messiah, the anointed of God, also known as Christ. So, it's March 11th, 2023. The time is 1942 hours. My name is Ward Green. Welcome to the study if you've just begun. Praise Jehovah and may Jehovah bless you as you seek first Jehovah's kingdom and all these other things then are added to you. Have a wonderful day. Bye for now. I love you very much.